Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program Verlin Klinkenborg. Hello, Verlin.
Hi, Vic. It's great to be back.
Are you on the West Coast?
I am on the West Coast, Southern California, but later in the week we're going to get ready to drive back east, back to the farm.
So you've been out there teaching?
Yeah.
Is that at Pomona?
Pomona College, yeah, teaching creative writing.
So it's kind of your yearly trip, isn't it?
Well, it's not yearly. It's more like every other spring. I think Southern California every year would probably do me in, but every couple of years it's a nice break.
That's right. We talked to you last summer, and you weren't going out there. I remember that.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you've just had a book come out that's a collection of pieces that you've written over the years for the New York Times. It's called More Scenes from the Rural Life. And the last time we chatted, you told me that you were working on this, and you were going back and you were rewriting a lot of these essays.
Not rewriting. Basically, what I was doing was finding the original drafts, because a lot of the pieces got compressed a little bit or edited some as they went into the Times. So what I was really doing was retrieving my original drafts and looking them over and making sure they were as useful as I thought they were, and basically restoring them to the condition that they were originally written in rather than the form they were published in the Times.
Well, from that last interview to this one, I'm guessing that you have literally found your voice.
Well, it's astonishing because the last time we talked, I had a papilloma, which is kind of a large wart growing on my vocal cords. In December, I had an operation, it's actually the fourth one like it, to remove it, and it was just phenomenally successful. I have back a voice that I haven't heard in 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been kind of amazing.
Well, I have always enjoyed these columns in the New York Times. Whenever I spot one and they appear on an irregular basis, It just kind of makes my day. How did you get the idea to write these?
Well, you know, it was kind of a collaboration, actually. When I first joined the Times, the editor of the editorial page was Howell Raines. And Howell had hired me partly because he wanted to revive the tradition of having a nature essay in the editorial page. And I had written a few, I'd actually written a number of freelance nature pieces for the editorial page over the previous 2 years. But in early 1998, he sat down and basically said, why don't we create a logo and just give you a recurring space called The Rural Life, and you can fill it as you see fit. And I really have to say that it was a leap of faith on Howell's part and kind of an extraordinary thing, because it's just not the sort of thing that you would naturally expect to find on the editorial page. But really, it's been, you know, 15 years now, and it's just kind of, it's changed as I've changed, it's changed as the farm's changed, but readers still stop me and try either to guess where my farm is, or they describe in their ideal imagination what my farm must look like. So I think for a lot of readers, it provides an imaginative link to a country life that is really important to them.
Verlin Klinkenborg joins us. His book is More Scenes from the Rural Life. I recently reread a Sand County Almanac, and you remind me at times of our fellow Iowan, Aldo Leopold.
Yeah, Leopold is, he's one of those figures who's really read more for his environmental message than for his prose, but he's a wonderful prose writer. And one of my favorite essays is by him. It's called The Farmer as Conservationist. And he just has a simplicity, a directness, and also a kind of an emotional understanding of the land that coexists with his scientific understanding of the land. It's very moving.
We've really lost the connection, haven't we?
Well, I think that it's funny because we have over a period of time. I'm astonished to say that, you know, there was a period when I would say that anybody under the age of 40 had no real link to the farm anymore. They had no grandparents or cousins who were farming. But what's happening now is a lot of the college students that I work with have far farming in their plans or they've already been farming. Where I live in the Hudson Valley, it's turned out to be kind of an epicenter for young people who really want to get their hands back in the soil. So there's really a new generation coming along, coming out of environmental sciences, coming out of volunteer work, but really with a strong desire to understand what it means to live locally and to eat locally and to take care of the land.
You close the book with a section about a man who was known as Peter Porcupine.
Yeah.
Has he been a big influence on you?
Well, I wouldn't say he's an influence in a way. His name, real name was William Cobbett. He's a great agrarian reformer from the early 19th century. I'm fascinated by him because he's probably the most important figure you've never heard of. He wrote millions of words. He wrote weekly newspaper that was the only independent newspaper in England for the first 30 years of the 19th century. And he lived in America. He lived in England. He introduced all sorts of new crops. But he's also just a superb writer of prose. And the book of his that appeared in the early 1820s called Rural Rides is basically just a story about Cobbett getting on his horse and riding out to see how the farmers are doing and talking to them in some detail about the nature of their lives and what's satisfactory and what's unsatisfactory. It's a very gripping glimpse at a way of life that was lost long, long, long ago.
In one of your pieces from the rural life, you recall driving through the Iowa countryside with your grandfather. You were a young boy,
yeah,
and he was only going about 35 miles an hour on this rural ride, and you couldn't stand it. But in reflection, you look back and you think, I wished I'd looked at what I was seeing as we went by.
Well, you know, I think everyone has that response to a certain degree to the past, which is it's not only I wished I'd really paid it more attention. You know, I remember a lot of it. I remember the scents and the sights, but I didn't actually know what they meant at the time. But the corollary to it is I wished I'd been able to listen more carefully to what my grandparents were saying and wished I'd been able to ask them questions about their own early farming life, things that just never really would have occurred to me as a kid to be interested in. And, of course, now it's far too late. And a whole two generations' worth of knowledge and experience just kind of went away.
So many of these pieces are about the weather or about the animals on your place, and it's really a wonderful thing to discover that your turkeys like hanging out with wild turkeys. I mean, I never knew that they did that.
Well, I didn't either, believe me. And I would have prepared better if I'd known it. I would have probably put a net over the turkey pen because, as it happened, they essentially kept trying to hang out with the wild turkeys until a fox got the two of them. Because the wild turkeys, of course, can fly and fly really well, but domesticated turkeys, not so much.
We've lost so much diversity. You go back and you look at the magazine The Country Gentleman from, what, 150 years ago, and you describe all the different varieties of fruit and animals, and we've become so monocultural. It's such a tragic thing.
Well, it's funny because, you know, some of those old varieties of pears and apples have been carefully preserved by orchardists over the years, and you know, there really has been an increasing effort over the last 30 or 40 years to make sure that we try to recover and preserve old breeds, old varieties. And it's a wonderful the reason I think it's important is partly because it keeps the gene pool diverse, but also because these various varieties, whether the varieties of beef cattle or dahlias or tomatoes, they represent the agricultural curiosity and invention of the human race. And it's one of the reasons why, in the center of the book, I write fairly sharply about the tendency in modern agriculture to basically remove genetic diversity from the hands of men and women who are actually farming and put it in the hands of corporations. what we're looking at is basically minute modifications to genomes that have been created by farmers over 10,000 years, and suddenly they're removed from the public sector and put in the private sector. It's a strange and shocking thing to watch.
I seem to recall you described this agribusiness focus on uniformity as the desire to create the habitat that matters as the one we create.
Yeah.
It's like we have this idea that what we're creating is somehow better
and more suited to us, and really only suited to us. But the dilemma there is, we didn't evolve in a customized, utterly human environment. We evolved in a very diverse, very complex, often threatening but definitely challenging environment in which every part of us had to respond mentally, physically. All of that, and the idea that we're moving into a universe where, as I say, we're trying to see how many species we can do without—it's become an uncontrolled experiment. We seem to be doing it without any intention. There's very little hope of really halting it, and what our lives will look like, and what we will look like as a species in the absence of so many other species. Is both a mystery and really a horrifying prospect.
The book is More Scenes from the Rural Life. Verlin Klinkenborg is our guest today. I grew up in Des Moines, and one time when we were in high school, we looked at the map, and we decided we wanted to go out on a spring day like today and drive to one of these remnants of native prairie. And we went out there and we just sat there all day, and it was really an amazing experience. And in one of your pieces, you talk about going to a place like this in Iowa and how even the wind sounds different.
Yeah, it's a place called Steel Prairie up near Cherokee. And, you get so used to, it sounds odd to say it, but the wind becomes monocultural too. You stand in a cornfield or near a cornfield in, say, early August, and the wind sounds like the rasping of corn, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But when you go out to one of the few remnants of original prairie left in the state, and there are some of them scattered all over the Midwest. First of all, it's populated by birds. Much wider array of insects. So there are those noises to begin with, but also you have the wind blowing through, 20 or 30 or 40 different species of plants instead of just one. And to me, it's a profoundly rich experience, especially because what you're looking at is not only these are the remainders of original prairie. But I think in most of the cases where that original prairie has been preserved, you're looking at a land surface that's actually higher than the fields around it, because the farm fields in Iowa have lost so much topsoil over the last century and a half that any place that was not planted crops is going to be, a foot to 18 inches higher than the surrounding level.
I read the New York Times every day, and I find so many stories that are profoundly disturbing. And then if I'm fortunate, I'll find one of your rural life essays on the opinion page. And it provides a calming influence on me after reading about all these upsetting things. You have such a meditative, reflective way of observing.
Well, thank you. And, it's important to me to really try to be able to convey a sense of what it means to live in nature, to live surrounded by animals. But it's also one of the things I try to do, and one of the reasons why this book is formatted a little differently than The Rural Life, is in this book I try to make it clear to readers in the section called Interlude that there is a lot of comfort to be found. There's a lot that's very soothing about this life, but it doesn't mean that I've let the serious issues go. There's a collection of about a dozen essays that appeared in the Times and in Yale Environment 360, which are really fairly sharp efforts to describe the predicament we're in, both as we look at the collapse of other species, but also as we think about the nature of big agriculture. I think it's important for readers to remember that I may sound calm and soothing on my farm, but basically I'm still writing editorials for the New York Times and filtering through tons and tons of bad news just the way you do.
I didn't realize that chickens don't really nest on their eggs anymore. You have a piece in there about an heirloom type of chicken who went and sort of adopted some eggs from another chicken. And you describe her sitting there, and her appearance even changes as she's taking care of this clutch of eggs.
Yeah, she's losing weight. She's absolutely obsessed. She, you know, you have to put food and water right next to her, and there's a sense of both kind of motherly protection, but also this sense of personal hoarding going on. But you know, it's one of the things that is very peculiar. You know, as animal breeds are adapted to human use, we tend to discard things that are not, you know, attributes that are not commercially useful. And one of the ones that was not commercially useful was broodiness, because when a chicken is brooding, it's not really laying eggs. It's, you know, certainly not gaining weight. In other words, it falls out of the production cycle. So basically, all the chickens that we eat in the supermarkets, all the eggs we none of them will sit on their eggs. If they do, it's a harking back to an earlier genetic model. Chickens are raised in incubators these days, and you know it certainly contributes to a kind of agricultural efficiency. But there is a sense in which you can argue that it's also a kind of genetic but cultural loss as well. The fact that people have no idea that this has gone missing.
You also observe the behavior of a lot of undomesticated creatures, because they mingle on your farm, like the turkeys, and you have one segment about a fox who is sick, who is looking for a place to die.
Yeah, it was really one of the most surprising things that ever happened at the farm. I walked down into the barn one evening and lifted a bale, and this really poor, pitiful fox with a bad case of mange and almost no hair kind of leaped up and stood in the middle of the barn kind of looking at me. And basically I put the bale down and watched him for a minute and walked away, because it was a miserable, wet night out, and mange basically removes the fur. So this was an animal that basically was all scalp. And you know, it's unusual to see it. It's not something that you normally experience by any means, and it calls up all sorts of questions about the kinds of stories we tell about the natural world in our experience.
I live in the country, in a little acreage out in rural Ohio, and whenever I see a woodchuck, I smile. I'm particularly fond of them, but my neighbors don't seem to like them. You have a piece that just made me laugh about the woodchuck getting in your garden, and as you observe, the woodchuck, instead of eating the good stuff, the vegetables that you're growing, starts eating weeds.
Yeah, I wish it were true of them all. I think that was a very special woodchuck, and you know, if we were in the business of breeding woodchucks, that's the one we would have taken our genetic sample from. I think I'm like a lot of people, which is I love seeing them because they are really they're comical in there, and they are part of the natural landscape. I have an adversarial relationship with them when they get into my garden, though, as most people do.
You've mentioned gardening a number of times, and there are quite a few essays in here about gardening. There's one that mentions the victory gardens of World War II and just how incredibly successful those were. We do seem to be having a bit of a renaissance in those, don't we?
Oh, I think in a very big way. It's actually staggering how much things have changed over the last 20 years. You know, if you go back to, a good example, I was looking at some issues of the Whole Earth Catalog and the Whole Earth Magazine from the early 1990s and late 1980s. And you can just see the glimmerings of this kind of, there's all this awareness of what we should be doing, but nobody's really quite doing it, and this is a way of contributing information to people who want to get out and garden. But no, there's been a huge renaissance, and it's really heartening to see, first of all, because people are taking responsibility for their own, raising their own food, but also I think it's a different way of spending time outdoors. It's both recreational but productive. It puts you in a position where you're actively observing the world around you, but you're also really a kind of passive observer as well. You're just essentially inhabiting your garden. And I think that's the beauty that most people who really come to love gardens discover, is that you start with the idea of ripe tomatoes and ripe ear corn, but pretty soon what really begins to interest you is the garden as a space to be occupied, a space to dwell in for part of the day.
Verlin Klinkenborg joins us. His book, More Scenes from the Rural Life, has just been published. I can remember a few years ago, you wrote a book called Timothy, Notes of an Abject Reptile.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that book, but there was very much a message in that, wasn't there?
Oh, very much so, yeah. The book is basically nonfiction. It's the story of a tortoise living in the garden of the natural historian Gilbert White in the 18th century. And the only thing that's really not nonfiction about it is the fact that the tortoise is doing the talking. And the tortoise is watching the natural historian instead of the other way around. And you know, one of the points of doing that, apart from the fun of it, was the opportunity to reflect from the tortoise's point of view on the strangeness of our extremely self-centered view of the world, how totally preoccupied we are by everything human, and how absolutely unaware we are of anything non-human.
When we had you on last year, your book, Several Short Sentences About Writing, had just come out in hardcover, one of my favorite books last year, and it's just come out in paperback.
That's right. Yeah.
I admire your writing so much, but I also admire the fact that you're a reader, and you have a very cute essay in there, in this new collection, where you talk about one of the things that kept you from doing your gardening in graduate school were a trio of villains, Dorothy Sayers, Raymond Chandler, and Patrick O'Brien.
Yeah. No, not Patrick O'Brien. I haven't read him. It must have been, I'm trying to remember who the third one would have been.
Okay.
But I know it's the same problem. Patrick O'Brien would have been a great problem to me if I'd known about him then.
Uh-huh.
I think part of it was that, you know, when you're in graduate school, you basically live in the library, and you live within the sort of very narrow bandwidth of your academic interests. And oddly enough, I think the two impulses were connected, the impulse to dig a garden and watch things grow, and also the impulse to read some mysteries, you know, something that wasn't, you know, 18th century poetry and something that wasn't Anglo-Saxon poetry. It was just so refreshing to turn on a part of my brain that seemed a little more trivial, but was nonetheless fascinated.
I think one of the essays that resonated the most with me was one that related to my own love for real books, and it's one where you talk about how your paperback's deterioration sort of marks the passage of time, and how a digitized book just isn't the same.
Yeah, it's funny because I have such a complicated relationship to digital books. I mean, I love physical books. And you know, as that essay notes, my actual books are aging at the same rate I am, which means that pretty soon I'm going to be held together with scotch tape and glue. But I think part of it is that I do love reading books on my iPad. I read a huge amount on my iPad, but there's still a beauty and a gravity in a physical book that nobody has quite figured out how to translate to the digital format yet. They still look sort of ill-considered and really not, it's as if basically it's an afterthought. And that's a mistake, because I think there's as much potential for beauty and a sense of physical space in the digital format as there is in actual physical books.
Well, some books are just so beautiful, and I've got to say that this one is one of them. The Princeton Architectural Press did a fabulous job on this book.
They're wonderful publishers. The owners and editors are friends of mine from the country, and I've admired their books for years, and I've written a couple of introductions for them in the past, and they make books really the old-fashioned way. This is the kind of book that you pick up and you just want to hold. You want to read it. It has that substantive quality that we all associate with good books. And it's funny too because there's almost a decade's worth of rural life pieces in here as opposed to the first rural life book, which has had about I'd say 4.5 years. And yet it doesn't seem overcrowded. It doesn't seem overburdened. And the illustrations by Nigel Peak are, to me, delightful because some of them are quite generic and some of them are strikingly evocative of my farm, and I won't tell you which ones.
Well, I always remove the dust jacket before I read because I want to keep the dust jacket in good shape. Mm-hmm. And I took the dust jacket off of this book and I said, wow, have you felt how thick this thing is?
Yeah, that's right.
I couldn't believe it, the gauge of the paper.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
No, since they publish books that are about art and architecture, they know how to think seriously about the graphic feel and the graphic content of a book.
I think the last time I talked to you, you had been doing quite a bit of traveling. You've been sailing. I think you went to Norway.
Yeah.
Or
I'd been to Ireland and Norway, and then later I was in Mozambique. And I've actually now sort of had, 6 or 8 months where I've just had a chance to teach and think and write. And it's been a really pleasant break.
One of the essays, you talk about listening to Middlemarch on your way out west. Mm-hmm. I know you're getting ready to go back east. Do you have an audio book that you're thinking about listening to?
We're thinking about Tom Jones.
Okay.
It's a book I love and have read in the past, but I've never listened to. And it's the kind of book that's long enough to get us all the way from Southern California back to the farm.
Well, Verlin, it's always great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Vic. It's always great chatting with you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook, and our guest today has been Verlin Klinkenborg. His new book is More Scenes from the Rural Life, and also just out in paperback, Several Short Sentences About Writing. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Did you know that our largest export to China is scrap metal? And a lot of that scrap metal is collected by people picking up scrap metal and collecting it to sell it. In Dayton, Ohio, there are a lot of people doing that. Steve Benish, a reporter for the Dayton Daily News, noticed, and he's written a book about it, very heavily illustrated with photos of scrappers. Tune in next week for Scrappers in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.